This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, making critical biblical scholarship accessible and fun. Yo.
Hi.
This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, and I'm not your grandma. I'm Jill.
Also not your grandma, Zach.
Hi, Zach. Not my grandma.
Hi, Jill. Not my grandma.
Yeah, so today we're going to talk about another woman in the Hebrew Bible. There are some really interesting stories here. And this one is found in Numbers 25. This is the story of the murder of Cosby. I refuse to call her Cosby. It's
for very specific reasons.
For very specific reasons. So Cosby bought Zur. Cosby, daughter of Zur. So this is a paper. This is going to be based off a paper that I had written several years ago around this. I've written on this passage a couple of times. One of them was in graduate school, and I don't remember what I had to say then. But this one I wrote also in grad school, but in the PhD program. and I'm particularly proud of it. It is the basis for the next big project that I'm going to work on, which I mentioned briefly at the end of our Judges 11 episode on Jephthah's daughter of, you know, men, the connection between these male wars and women's bodies. So we'll talk a little bit about that through this and how I think that this particular scene is really working to forge the identity of Phinehas the priest over against these other bodies, with Cosby sort of being the epicenter of that. So Numbers 25 is a really difficult story. So at the very beginning, while Israel was staying at, I always want to pronounce them Shittim. It might be Shittim.
Shittim's fine.
Okay.
That's a little...
sounds a little less offensive.
Moves it away a little further.
So it says the people began to have sexual relation with the women of Moab. That's an important word, Moab. So these women of Moab invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to the Moabite gods. The people of Israel yoked themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger was kindled against Israel. And so the Lord says to Moses, take all the chiefs of the people and impale them in the sun before the Lord. This is some like Game of Thrones level monstrosity. Impale them in the sun in order that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses says to the judges of Israel, each of you shall kill any of your people who have yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor. I'm trying to like be a little bit more like Hebrew in my pronunciation, and I feel like I sound just real Southern. Baal of Peor.
Baal of Peor.
That's the setting for what's about to happen. Is Israelite men are intermarrying with Moabite women and becoming worshippers of the Moabite gods, which again, ancient Israelites were not monotheistic; they were henotheistic. They did not believe in only one god; they worshipped only one god.
I think that's monolatrist.
Okay.
Or both.
I don't know.
Monolatry.
I may have just made up a word.
No,
I thought I read it the other day, but...
No, that's it.
Monolatry
is, I think, exists the acknowledgement that there are other gods, but it's the worship of only one of those. So they were technically monolatrists.
So there's definitely concern. So when it says the Lord gets angry about this, I mean, remember that God has given a command, like, only worship me. I'm a jealous God. So then they're intermarrying with these Moabite women and becoming worshipers of it. Maybe not exclusive worshipers of the Moabite God, but they are no longer exclusive worshipers of the Israelite God.
Correct.
And that is the problem. I am the Lord your God is one. You're only going to worship me.
Right.
So get off the Moabite bandwagon. The problem is that the story that is about to happen with Cosby is that she's not a Moabite woman, she's a Midianite woman. And these two categories get conflated. So Miss Midianite woman, later named Cosby, goes into the tent of meeting with her Israelite husband. And Will Gaffney in Womanist Midrash, which you should definitely pick up and read it. I've been reading through it. I just finished Exodus. I'm starting in the Leviticus chapter. It's a reintroduction to women of the Torah and the throne. Is masterpiece too strong of a word?
I don't think so. No, it is.
It is incredible. It is. She's so insightful to say anything fresh about specifically the women in Genesis, because the women in Genesis get a lot of play, is really impressive. So I definitely recommend picking up. But she says that this is happening on the wedding day of the Israelite man and the Midianite woman, because the tent that they go in, so they go into the tent of meeting. Phinehas is the grandson of Aaron through Eleazar. Caesus gets up, follows them into their tent, which is the word for their tent is, I think she said it's kibbutz, and it's like a wedding tent.
Okay.
and stabs them with a spear through what gets translated as her belly. But Dr. Gaffney argues that it's a crude pun, and it's basically saying in the tent he stabs her through her woman tent, so her womb, and stabs the Israelite man as well, Zimri. They both die, and in response to this zealousness, God praises Phinehas for turning back the wrath of God from the Israelites by manifesting such zeal among them on God's behalf, and that in God's jealousy, God did not consume the Israelites. And so God says, it shall be for him, Phinehas, and for his descendants after him, a covenant of perpetual priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the Israelites. And then it says the name of the slain Israelite man was Zimri, son of Salu, head of an ancestral house belonging to the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianite woman was Cozbi, daughter of Zur, who was the head of a clan, an ancestral house in Midian. Later in Numbers 31, we find out that Zur is considered a king of the Midianites. He's one of the five kings of Midian, and he is killed in the war that ensues. And then God calls on the Israelites to go to war with the Midianites to defeat them, which is accounted for in November 31st. Numbers 31. My brain is mashed potato. So the plague that had been upon the people for their intermarriage with the Moabites is removed through the murder of an intermarried Israelite and Midianite. So as you can see, there are some discontinuities within the story, and we'll get to some of those. The first one is the Moabite turns to Midianite issue, and that is probably because we're looking at the conflation of a couple of sources under the redactional eye of a very not astute priest, is what it seems to be happening.
Whoops.
A really crash course on documentary hypothesis of the Torah, so the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. Super crash course. Four sources, whether you think of them as being four different communities that had sources. So similar to synoptic problem questions of like, what are our sources and our communities behind these sources?
Quite similar, yeah.
Quite similar. So you have your Eloist source, who tends to use the name Elohim to talk about God. You have the Yahwist source, who tends to use the Tetragrammaton to talk about God's name. And then you have the priestly source, which, as you can imagine, is concerned with priestly things. So, like, basically the whole book of Leviticus is from the priestly hand. Maybe with a few things here or there interjected. But a good example of the Eloist versus the Yahwist source is in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. We have two different creation stories. Oh, I'm just kidding. Genesis 1 is the priestly source, so that's not a good example. But that's still a conflation of two sources. Yeah. You've got the priestly source with Genesis 1, and I think it's the Eloist source for Genesis 2.
That sounds right.
But anywhere you see all caps Lord, that is the Tetragrammaton. And
what's the Tetragrammaton?
Oh, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, name for God. Right? So yes. The unpronounceable name of God.
So the four letters in Hebrew. So it's a Yod, a He, a Vav, and a He.
Okay.
And so it gets transliterated into English. If you've ever seen all caps YHWH, that is the approximation from Hebrew.
Right.
And so
or YHVH.
YHVH or YHWH. And then that is called the Tetragrammaton because tetra for grammaton.
Letters.
Letters, yeah. So it's not pronounced, and so, yeah, in English, whenever you see capitalized L-O-R-D, that is, in the text, it is not written out Lord or any other name. It is actually the four letters there.
Right. So as we mentioned before, with Hebrew, there weren't vowels. You just have these consonants with a couple of consonants functioning vowelish occasionally.
Sometimes,
yeah. And then later, if you see all the dots around it, that's the vowels being inserted to help with pronunciation purposes. And so when you have the Tetragrammaton, the vowel pointings for this, because it's unpronounceable, or should be, tend most often the pointings for Adonai.
Correct.
Put on. So it's a very, it makes it where if you are somebody reading Hebrew and you saw this, you know to buzz past it, don't say it. It's intended to be unpronounceable, although some people have tried to make it pronounceable, and that's where you get Jehovah.
And it's legitimately not a legit name.
Yeah, it's not a name of God.
It's,
it is a conflation of
it's two. It's taking Adonai's, if you go in Hebrew, it's a quick Hebrew lesson. If you go in Hebrew, you take the vowels off of the word Adonai, and you put those underneath the Tetragrammaton. That's how you get Jehovah or Yehovah. And so it's not, it's literally two things smashed together. And so.
So it is certainly not the name of God.
And part of that, I think, comes from the fact that Adonai So when you learn Hebrew and you're practicing reading, if you have a good professor, they will instruct you to not try and pronounce that name for a number of reasons. So you have to say, you can't just not say anything.
Yeah.
So you have to come up with something in there. And usually the probably top two that people default to are either Adonai, which means Lord or Lords, depending on where it shows up in context, or Hashem, which means the name. Mm-hmm. Those are probably the top two that come up that way. There's some other ones too, but so you have to come up with something to say for an unpronounceable name
right. That's
not the unpronounceable name.
And sometimes you'll have people say the name, or Gaffney's book, she uses lots of ways, and she does it in all caps, but like, the Lord of all flesh, or the Lord of, and so she kind of contextualizes within the passage. Mm-hmm. So that's the Yahweh source. Back to what we're
back to
Cosby. Don't worry. And then you have the priestly source, like I said, concerned with priestly things. And then you have the Deuteronomist source, primarily in Deuteronomy. And so those are sort of the four source components that a long time in the making come together and then form what we see now as our Torah text, our first five books text. So what we're seeing here in chapter 25 is we're seeing a conflation of a couple of sources. So we definitely have the Yahweh source in here, but it seems to be two stories get mashed together, and then the priestly hand is kind of over it because Phinehas is a priest. And so there seems to be a bit of a rehabilitation of Phinehas in this text. And so that's why there thinks to be a priestly hand at work here. Because, again, most people seeing this would read this and be like, yo, you just murdered some people. And even though it seemed to be efficacious for whatever happens here, bro. So that's one of the first things just to know, is that's why we have the Moab switching to Midianite, is we've got these two sources where we have a story about, because of the Moabite intermarriage, there's a plague and that has to be redeemed. And then we have this other story of Phinehas killing an intermarried couple of Israelite and Midianite women, and those get conflated. So that's the thing that gets rid of the plague. One of the things I do want to note about this particular passage is how Cosby in the interpretive history gets erased.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of really, really interesting ways. So I'm only going to mention just a couple because of time, but they're all pretty influential. So Martin Noth, he did a commentary on Numbers back in 1968. He really doesn't acknowledge the violence that's done to Cosby in this text. So he admires Phinehas' actions, and he says, quote, that these actions were not exactly a heroic deed, but laudable as a reaction on the spur of the moment, not only with regard to the action of the individual Israelite that had just taken place, but also with regard to the apostasy of the people, so that the plague inflicted on account of the latter, which had accounted for numerous deaths, could now be removed by God. So he really identifies with Phinehas in this scene. And because he's identifying here with Phinehas, with the ideology of this text that wants you to identify with Phinehas, this foreign woman then just totally gets ignored in his commentary. He doesn't acknowledge in the story a human being is murdered for being a wife and a Midianite, and that's it. He never mentions her name in his comments. Please note, she's named in the text. And this gets even more poignant. So John Sturdy's commentary on Numbers from 1976, this is how he treats it. So verse 14 reads in the text, the name of the slain Israelite man who was killed with the Midianite woman was Zimri, son of Salu, head of an ancestral house, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he writes, Zimri, son of Salu. The name seemed to be added by a later writer as an afterthought. Perhaps the writer is slyly attacking contemporaries of his who trace their descent from Zimri of Salu. Verse 15 reads, the name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Cosby, daughter of Zur, who was head of the clan and ancestral house in Midian. Sturdy writes, daughter of Zur. Zur is one of the Midianite kings in 31a. He erases her entire existence in his comments and only pays attention to the dad. Now, you might want to say, those were before feminist criticisms really got much airplay, so we can't really fault them for not noticing women in the text. I don't think that matters.
However,
but we've got some more contemporary treatments that do something similar. So in the Anchor Bible Dictionary from 1992, Cosby's identity is viewed almost entirely in sexual terms.
Mm.
So Rodney Hatton, who's writing this entry, he gives Cosby agency by saying that she was, quote, engaged in an illicit activity with an Israelite. Apparently marriage was illicit. However, that agency that he gives her is an implication of guilt, and then it sort of functions as a justification of the violence that's done to her. So then he considers the etymology of her name, which is either from the Akkadian kuzbu or kuzabu, meaning voluptuous and sexually vigorous, or it's from the Hebrew kazab, meaning deceitful. So clearly she's being given a name that's just really intended to denigrate her.
Yeah.
So he rehearses the debate concerning, quote, the nature of Cosby's offense. Again, victim blaming, trying to find out why'd she get murdered.
Yeah.
We see this a lot. Oh, look at her wearing pink. Clearly she wanted it.
Yeah.
It's enraging. So he posits mixed marriage, adultery, cultic prostitution, and apostasy as possibilities. Although I don't know how she's an apostate when she's not an Israelite required to worship the one God.
Yep.
Guys, I'm getting fired up. So then he presents a couple of interpretations by Mendenhall and Reif. They both present Cosby as this alluring temptress who lured Zimri into covenant infidelity.
Mm.
So his entire definition, remember, we're looking at a dictionary of the Bible here.
Yeah.
His definition of Cosby is an attempt to define her as other and to make sense of her death and make her responsible in some ways for her death.
Mm-hmm.
So he represents the witch hunt, as I'm going to call it, that this text invokes. So this is a punishment in search of a crime. Thomas Dozeman in 1998 in the New Interpreter's Bible doesn't really do much better. And New Interpreter's Bible is like a pretty go-to standard for ministers, for academic researchers.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty reputable. And so he takes this text at face value. He focalizes where it focalizes, and he obscures the violence that's being done to Cosby in this text. So he doesn't praise the actions of Phineas, so that's a plus. But he doesn't really question or challenge them either. Mm. And at several points, he compares Phineas's actions with Aaron's role in appeasing divine wrath in 16:41 through 50, and Moses's focus on punishing the guilty individuals rather than the whole people in 25:5, and even Phineas's own later leadership in the war against Midian. So the comparison with Aaron and Moses sort of elevates his status as this leader and model in this interpretation here. And then the in New Interpreters, it has sort of a commentary, and then it also has a reflections. So you sort of have your academic and then your more ministerial readings of the text. So he reads the scene as a metaphor, and he says that Numbers 25 serves to demonstrate how Christians, like Israel, should be in the world but not of it. He argues that the text demonstrates God's requirement for faithfulness and that Christians should resist external temptations that attempt to pull them away from God. The identification with Israel and the God of Israel in this metaphorical reading subtly implicates Cosby as responsible for her own demise. This implication is later spelled out. He writes, quote, "By executing the guilty and halting the plague on all the people, Phineas also qualifies indiscriminate divine wrath so that the innocent are not punished," end quote. So for this guy, for Dozeman, Cosby is guilty and she deserves what she got.
Gross.
It's gross.
That's gross.
That's the interpretive history of this text. So my problems here are that these readings, they see what the text wants you to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the sort of key elements of a feminist hermeneutic is not just hate the dudes, but it's resisting. It's resisting reading against the grain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the text wants me to see Phineas as this good guy, and this is an action that appeases. What else is in here? What if I identify instead as a woman with the woman in the text? And that's where I start seeing these levels of identity and power being worked out. And so I've identified three, and hopefully we can get through all of them. So we have, first of all, Israel versus Midian, or Israel versus the non-Israelite other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we have priests versus the Israelite other. So priests versus Zimri kind of thing. And then we have male versus female, or the gendered other, right? For each of these, I want to look at the way Cosby's body is being used to legitimate the Israelite, male, Aaronite priest over all others.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So really seeing this as a construction of Phineas's identity being crafted here. In that sense, yes, he's being rehabilitated by this text. So certainly in this scene, proper worship is the key distinguisher between Israel and the other.
Mm-hmm.
So the scene is set at the Tent of Meeting, or the wilderness sanctuary. God is real mad because the Israelites have attached themselves to Baal Peor. So Phineas, who's sort of the hero of the story, if you're just reading along with it, he's a Levite, and he's the grandson of Aaron, and he's given a divine pact of friendship and priesthood. So cultic purity really sets the tone for this whole scene. Israelite identity is first and foremost defined in terms of their relationship with God. This relationship is really threatened by the existence of other gods, in part because other gods were others' gods, right? So if you destroy the other, then you destroy the threat. And in this scene, Cozbi is the other, right? She's the non-Israelite, Midianite woman in their midst. And it's set up as being about improper worship, even though it's gods of Moab, not gods of Midian, and it's very different, right? Cozbi sort of embodies this threat of other gods in a couple of ways. So first, her naming, like I said, in Akkadian, it can mean voluptuousness, sexuality, sensuality. In Hebrew, it denotes falseness and worthlessness. And Cozbi then is identified as a threat to Israel's relationship with God by her sexuality. So idolatry is often euphemized sexually, you know, so they knew other gods. It's always blamed on women. So her sexuality in one sense serves as a metaphor for idolatry here. While Zimri is sort of a representative Israelite, Cozbi is a representative seductress luring Zimri into improper worship. Now there's a person, Harriet Lutsky, and she writes that Cozbi was an attribute of several Mesopotamian deities and may have evoked Astarte, Ishtar's West Semitic counterpart, or Asherah, the West Semitic goddess whose name is most closely associated with the early Israelites.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So at this level, her name then moves her beyond just a representative seductress of the Midianite people to a representative goddess.
Mm.
And so she's not just a threat to the Israelites, but she's in rivalry with God's self. And that's big.
Yeah.
And then finally, she's not just any Midianite woman. She's the daughter of Zur. She's a Midianite princess, essentially.
Mm.
And Zimri's not just any Israelite. He's the son of a Simeonite chieftain. So this marriage, if that is indeed what it is, there are other possibilities that I'll bring up. But like I said, Will Gaffney definitely believes that this is a marriage. Might likely have had important political significance for these clans, which I'm not suggesting that political significance was divorced from religious significance. Mm-hmm. Everything was really intertwined. But political ramifications of the marriage might have called into question societal structure and the Levitical claim to leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So Carolyn Pressler, in The Biblical View of Marriage, it's a really good chapter, writes that in the Older Testament, marriage is less a matter between two individuals and more a union of two families.
Yeah, right.
So among these upper classes, these households sought alliances that would increase their power and property. So this is a really high-profile marriage that could foster peaceful diplomacy between the tribes, as well as military strength in the event of an attack. So Cozbi then also represents, as a representative Midianite, the threat to the solidarity of the Israelite congregation. That's just a couple of ways that we've got sort of this othering of her ethnically, in a sense. And then we have this priest versus the other Israelites. So the Aaronite priests really distinguished themselves from non-Levite tribes in the biblical text. And so Claudia Camp, she cites 15 instances where the non-Levites are called zar or stranger,
mm-hmm.
and are forbidden from access to priestly items, such as like food of atonement, sacred donations, anointing oil, blah, blah, blah. In each of her cited examples, the non-Levite is restricted in their access to priestly items, and death is prescribed for those who approach the sacred space and the Aaronite priests. So within the Levites, the Aaronites are even a more narrow class.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's really not even enough for the Levites to be distinct from non-Levites. Claudia Camp writes, "The pie is sliced thinner yet. The Aaronite priests must be distinguished not only from the people in general, but even from other members of the Levitical ancestral group." And so she describes the non-Aaronite Levites as neither fully czar nor fully priest.
Mm.
And she observes that a distinction being made between the Aaronite Levites and other Levites is found in Numbers 3. In that passage, the priestly roles of the Kohathites, which is Aaron's father's house, are differentiated from those of Aaron's clan. So it's only Aaron's clan that is allowed to perform the sanctuary duties. So mm-hmm. there's really
right.
this narrowing and narrowing and narrowing of the most important. So power, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the prominence of the Aaronite clan is made not only against other Israelites and Levites, but against other Aaronites as well. So we have Levites, Aaronites, and now within the Aaronites, it's going to get even... The super Aaronites. So Camp again, she observes that the czar is the outsider to the chosen priestly lineage, but the line between inside and outside proves unstable, so the circle of insiders tends to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And she gives us this example of Leviticus 10. So in Leviticus 10, two of Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, are consumed with fire after offering strange fire to God. So a common issue in the priestly writings is that the lineage basis of distinctive priesthood, that is the equation of ritual correctness with genealogical correctness, in a society that features itself from all one lineage. Like, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that scene of Aaron's sons being consumed by fire demonstrate that Aaronite Levites are worthy of their sacred duties, but it's not enough simply to be Aaronite.
Right.
And that's just another level. So it's getting thinner. And as you remember, Phinehas is the grandson. So it's like this inverted triangle. The distinction, it's being made in this text between Phinehas from other Israelites and then other Levites as well. He's got a particular pedigree.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And his pedigree defines him against Zimri and Cozbi. And then we've got this distinction between Phinehas and even Moses. So 25:4-5, God commands Moses to publicly impale the heads of the people who have attached themselves to Baal Peor. Moses then instructs his officials to kill those men. In the received text, so what we have, pretending that we don't have a conflation of sources, or maybe not pretending, but this is what we have. Moses is given the command to deal with the idolatry, but Phinehas is the one who acts by killing Zimri and Cozbi. And Phinehas is rewarded for his action with a pact of friendship and a pact of priesthood. So in this short scene, Phinehas' identity is forged. And again, to quote Claudia Camp, the lineage of true priests and the identity of an Israel separate from foreigners are established in a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
So Cozbi's body, then, I read it as being this pawn in Phinehas' game. Her presence with a non-Levite Israelite at the tent of meeting gives rise to Phinehas' quasi-fulfillment of a command given to Moses. And then she must die if Phinehas is to be a worthy Aaronite. I like how Claudia Camp summarizes this. She says, right family plus right nationality plus right ritual space plus right sex equals established priestly lineage. So that's the equation here.
Mm-hmm.
And at that level, Cozbi is a threat to the priestly preoccupation with the purity of lineage and sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, we've got this gendered other, right? One, as I brought up earlier, one of the most frustrating aspects of this interpretation of this passage is this search for her crime.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what did she do that got her killed? And that line of questioning, I think, betrays an inherent identification with Phinehas and a misunderstanding of gender dynamics. So Cozbi's crime was that she was a Midianite woman. And in the opinion of Phinehas and the God of the text here, who commands the death of any outsider who approaches the tent of meeting, so that's in Numbers 1, Numbers 3, and Numbers 18, her presence at the tent was her death sentence. But if we question identifying with Phinehas and the God of this text, and I say God of the text rather than God behind the text, because I don't think this is representative of who God is, but instead we pay attention to Cozbi and identify with her, then I think we see something different. So there's not anything in this story that lets you know that Cozbi acted autonomously. She's considered a seductress who enticed Zimri into idolatry. But the problem with idolatry is connected with Moab, not Midian. Literally a few verses before. I think they make that jump from Moab to Midian because she's just a woman. I mean, they're all the same. You know what I mean?
Pretty much.
Exactly. No nuance in any of us. Sarcasm. So by focusing on her body as a woman, especially one who's being pejoratively called Cozbi, she must be a seductress and a threat to the Israelite purity, right? At least that's how interpretations of the scene are constructed. But instead, if we consider, like, Zimri brought her near to the tent of meeting, not the other way around. She didn't drag him there. Her presence on the sacred ground of the tent is not of her volition, at least according to the text that we have. She's passive, indicating that it's not her actions that lead to her death. Rather, it is her otherness. And then when Zimri and Cozbi exit to the chamber or her tent, Phinehas is said to follow only the Israelite, perhaps indicating that, again, Zimri is leading Cozbi where she should go and ultimately to her death. There's agency that's ascribed to her, but it's agency intended to make it where she deserved what she got.
Mm-hmm.
She's not an Israelite. Why would she even know the command that she couldn't be at the tent of meeting? Zimri should know that, not her.
Right.
And then the way she's killed, again, speaks to her womanness, her femininity. Helena Savon has this really provocatively titled article called The Rape of Cozbi.
Mm.
And she argues that Phinehas' use of the spear to pierce her belly is symbolic. She writes, her chief attribute as a woman, namely her potential to bear children, is her undoing. Phinehas uses a weapon that resembles a male sexual organ. By selecting a womb as target, he rapes her. And that's similar to how while Gaffney is reading this, when when she reads it as he plunges the spear through her woman tent. It's a pun, it's crude, it's mean, and it is sexual. And it's really disturbing. Finally, I think it's significant that the first kill of a Midianite before their subsequent annihilation in Numbers 31 is a woman. So by killing Cozbi, Phinehas, his actions really foreshadow chapter 31, which is where the war is described. Neely S. Fox states that Phinehas' role in the battle against the Midianites was so that he could finish the sacred task he began when he smote the Midianite woman in the affair of Baal Peor. I don't think it's that simple. I don't think it's just Phinehas finishing what he started. So there's a book that's called Postcolonial Feminist Interpretation of the Bible by Musa Dubey, and she argues that women often become the indicators of different lands and cultures. And so she calls it the Rahab reading prism. And so her story is that when the Israelite spies go into Canaan, to Jericho, and meet Rahab, and she welcomes them, that's an indication that the land will be theirs. So whatever the encounter is with a woman, that's the encounter with the people,
right?
Or the land.
Right.
She writes that an encounter with a woman often foreshadows the desires of the colonizer and the fate of the land. So if we follow this Rahab reading prism for Cozbi, her body then is symbolic of the Midianite land. And her father, Zur, being one of the five kings killed by the Israelites, is important. But her death in Numbers 25 is his death in Numbers 31. Cozbi's death was the death of the Midianites. And in this light, Numbers 31 is nearly superfluous. Anybody with that prism in mind, understanding if that's a trope, which Musa Dubey argues that it is, when they heard this story, they knew they were going to be, that the Numbers 31 account would be successful. I find, however, Numbers 31 to be a little bit sadly ironic. So God has ordered the people through Moses to take vengeance on the Midianites, right? 1,000 members from each tribe, with Phinehas serving as priest for the crusade, battled Midian, killing all the men, including five kings. Cozbi's father Zur is listed among those kings killed. After the battle, Moses commanded that every male among the children and every woman that has known a man sexually be killed. This is essentially a genocidal project in which they are going to rape the Midianites out of existence.
Yeah.
So men die, children die, and if a woman is not a virgin, and therefore the paternity of any child could be in question, must die. But he allows any woman who has not known a man sexually to be spared. So Catherine Dube Sackenfield, with other scholars, she notes that presumably the virgin women exempted from extermination will become sexual partners of the Israelite men. That seems to be what's going on. The war booty is the women, these virginal women that they're going to take captive and intermarry with, which is the whole problem at the beginning of the story. Anyway,
full circle.
So had Cozbi not married Zimri and remained a virgin, she might have survived the Israelite invasion. And it's not impossible that Zur had other virgin daughters that did survive and were integrated into Israelite society, thus living the life Cozbi could have lived. And I think these possibilities indicate that Numbers 25 is more concerned with constructs of Israelite and priestly identity and power than with actual people, obviously. And I think it's interesting to note that there are allowances made for Israelite relations with Midianite women, but in the terms of those relationships have to be conquest and domination. They cannot be free will.
Yeah.
So the text isn't even about Cozbi. It's about these men, and yet she's a casualty in this battle. She was understood as a weapon that was going to pollute the Israelite community, and this priest Phinehas, as somebody who had the right to protect the sanctity of the Israelites' purity and the right to a woman's body, destroys Cozbi. And I should know, I'm not concerned with the historical plausibility of the scene. I don't think that that's anything that we can get at.
No.
It does seem to me that there must have been somebody named Phinehas and from the priestly line, and he needed some rehabilitation, and this is one way to do it. But whether this story actually happened or not does not undo the ideology of the text, this idea that the other can be killed in the name of God. And I just think that that's really, really problematic. So I think a challenge that we can take away from a text like this is, instead of just jumping to identifying with Phinehas, with these Israelites, and the ideological justification of violence against the other in our own context, which mm-hmm. is prevalent. I think that if we could learn to identify with the victim, with Cosby in this case, I think that we could learn to resist some of this religiously sanctioned violence against women and against any constructed other.
Yeah. I mean, another way of thinking about that, maybe in different terms, is in-group, out-group thinking. Yeah. So I think, you know, if you think about who your group is and you think about, you know, you're in this group and everybody else is outside of the group, and it's easy to demonize and be angry about or assign blame to people who are on the outside of the group. And so I think the story represents, using that sort of a framework, you know, what are the ways that we can think about the out-group, you know, and the ways in which they have their own group in that mm-hmm. sense too. So what does it mean, Israelite versus Midian? What does it mean, our country versus another country? Yeah. You know, so what is it about our country that makes it okay to do something against somebody else in defense of our country? So it becomes a much more complicated conversation and question rather than simply, what is it that I need or what is right mm-hmm. for me? It's, you know, what's right for everybody in the situation. And so something to think about.
Yeah. Well, another bummer of an episode. Sorry, guys.
We're just full of bummers.
We'll come up with something happy.
Eventually.
Maybe. Anyway, bye.